Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 10 of Topical Fever. My name is David Parsons, and I thank you very much for joining me today on the podcast. Spring is taking its time here in Brooklyn. It's still, I think, about 50 degrees outside, even though we're approaching May here. You can probably hear birds in the background. The birds are out, and they're here. They're singing. They're kind of waiting for spring, and I think they look very, very cold to me. They're confused by how cold it still is and why it's not 75 degrees and sunny. And as a guy from Southern California, I'm wondering the same thing myself. I feel sorry for the birds. I just saw a couple of birds trying to drag a space heater up a tree outside, and that's one of the sadder things I've seen here in Brooklyn. We'll be talking a little bit about Brooklyn today, about the sad things we've seen. I have Justin Rogers Cooper back on the show to talk about the phenomenon of hipsters and gentrification, and I'll certainly have a few things to say about that in a second. But first, I wanted to address a little bit of what's going on in the larger world. Of course, last episode I mentioned that the Boston Marathon bombing had just occurred, and so I didn't want to really comment on it yet because everybody was commenting on it, and that's kind of one of the things we've learned now a week later, right? Is that maybe the cacophony of democracy that the internet has let loose has led us down a kind of path in which the witch hunt becomes a worldwide phenomenon and one that might not be particularly healthy. Many mistakes made not only by people on sites like Reddit and things like that, but by large media organizations like the New York Post, who put pictures of the wrong guys on the cover very embarrassingly and very dangerously, I might add. CNN had all sorts of very public screw-ups. It made me wonder why people follow this media at all if there's going to be so much constant speculation. And you know, certainly I'm excited about the possibilities of the internet and what it can do for us in terms of information and transforming minds, and I wouldn't be on a podcast if I didn't think that was true. But on the other hand, in situations like quote-unquote terrorism cases in which there's a significant amount of hysteria and misinformation, I think that we face a kind of cultural problem that we need to look at. I certainly don't suggest any kind of censorship of the internet. Certainly that's something that's going on anyway. But on the other hand, we have to find a way to calm ourselves down a little bit. And speaking of calm ourselves down, my friend Jeremy Cagle, who will be joining us on the show in a couple episodes from now when we talk about The Sopranos, Jeremy and I had an email exchange this morning in which he pointed out a movie from a few years ago called The Siege with Bruce Willis and Denzel Washington, Tony Shalhoub, and it was Annette Bening was the actress in that. The Siege is a movie that kind of is about a terrorism happening in New York City. It came out in the 90s or the late 90s, just a few years before 9/11, and it offers a kind of terrifying scenario of not only terrorism but even more so kind of police and military repression resulting from a fear of terrorism. And what Jeremy was pointing out is that in this movie, the scenario in which, you know, the Bruce Willis character plays like a hardcore military dude that basically takes over New York City, puts a barbed wire around Central Park, begins terrorizing and rounding up the Muslim population of New York City and throwing them into pens in New York in Central Park. What Jeremy was pointing out was that in that movie, that scenario is without a doubt portrayed as extreme and crazy and overkill and outside the bounds of American constitutional liberties, but also outside the bounds of our experience as Americans at all. And here we are, you know, a few years later, and I say a few, but I mean, you know, 15 years later, after we've gone through a kind of post 9/11, I would say, reevaluation, to say the least, of our collective values led by the U.S. government, we get to a point where we see that scenario from The Siege take place on a smaller scale in the town of Watertown in Massachusetts as a result of this Boston bombing. And that kind of militarized police presence, door-to-door searches, and all the kinds of displays of government military police authority that we saw was kind of accepted across the board, I would say, by a large portion of the population. I think that that's kind of a comment on where we are at culturally, politically, socially, in terms of what we expect and what's on the landscape of possibility for us. So you know, I don't know where we're going with that, but Justin and I will certainly be talking about that in the future. The other thing that I do want to mention. There are a few dangerous precedents being set here. I am happy that the Obama administration has decided to try the remaining living suspect in this bombing in civilian court. I think it would have been obviously a dangerous precedent to follow the Bush administration into that, you know, kind of area of military tribunals and declaring enemy combatant status, which we all know is just kind of a euphemism for stripping people of constitutional liberties. I think that obviously would have set a dangerous precedent. So I don't know if the word happy applies here, but I'm relieved in a sense that they didn't go down that route. On the other hand, though, there are some other dangerous precedents being set. One is that the dude, for lack of a better term, I won't call him an enemy combatant. I'll call him a dude. This 19-year-old dude, who is accused of this crime, has been charged with using a weapon of mass destruction, which I thought was incredibly interesting language. And I'm not the only one to point that out. In fact, the New York Times article that is about this today has lots and lots of comments from all sorts of people, kind of questioning that. The choice of those charges and the choice of those words, weapon of mass destruction, particularly when you think about the fact that, you know, this was a weapon that killed three people, injured a bunch of people, not to minimize any of that. But the kinds of incidents that we've seen recently with guns, including Newtown, including the Aurora shooting, in which dozens of people were shot with high-powered automatic weapons easily available without a background check. Thank you, Congress. Those crimes are not charged as crimes using weapons of mass destruction. In other words, there's something weird semantically going on there, and obviously guns are being protected legally, meaning that it's kind of weird that the bombing is being declared an act of terrorism and a deployment of a weapon of mass destruction. When incidents like the Dark Knight shooting or the Newtown shooting are not considered terrorism or use of weapons of mass destruction. In other words, I think there's something going on there with the word terrorism and mass destruction, and maybe people that are Muslim. It seems like that's the dividing line. But there's also obviously the fact that guns are not labeled weapons of mass destruction, which is very curious and kind of tips your hat to a little bit of the underlying ideology there. Okay, so in this episode, Justin and I talked about cities again, and this kind of ties into the conversation that Claudia and I had last week about Los Angeles and New York City. Justin and I have a conversation about hipsters and gentrification. And when we say hipsters, we end up, you know, after an hour of talking, I think we finally decided that the hipster is a ghost, that we're chasing a phantom, that like any other kind of cultural stereotype, there is it does have some explanatory or descriptive power. But when we say hipster, we mean a whole kind of range of codes and iconographies and ideologies and politics that is not agreed upon. That is an amorphous definition. And as a guy that I think can walk down the street and be pretty confident that people are thinking the word hipster in their mind, I wonder what the range of those ideologies and politics and everything else, what they are and how they're invested in this stereotype. So we talked about the hipster in relation to the larger kind of phenomenon of gentrification in New York City and the changes that have been taking place in New York City over the last 15 or 20 years in the context of this this hipster phenomenon. In many different circles, the hipster is kind of the word is employed as a shorthand for gentrifier. So Justin and I wanted to get to the bottom of that and figure out, is that true? Who is the driving force behind gentrification? Is the hipster just a kind of scapegoat, or is there an actual truth to what's going on here in New York City? Because the city is changing, and while it's true that it always changes, and we certainly have we address this in our conversation, it also can be said that New York City is changing exponentially faster right now than it ever has before. There's something afoot in New York City. It has to do with Bloomberg. It has to do with banks. It has to do with luxury apartments. It has to do with globalization and multinational corporations. And it has to do with the larger kind of context of global politics right now. So I hope you enjoy this conversation between Justin and I, in which we take apart hipsterism, we address Portlandia, and we try to figure out how all that fits into gentrification. Here's me and Justin. Really, we're talking about Brooklyn. I think I should maybe set it up a little bit. That we're talking about Brooklyn and what's going on, I guess, culturally, politically, and economically in Brooklyn, right?
Well, Brooklyn, I would say all of New York. You know, yeah. I think it's happening in the Bronx. It's happening in Queens.
True.
It's happening in Brooklyn.
So maybe the stereotype of the hipster is locating it in Brooklyn, and maybe that's another problem with connecting hipsterism and gentrification, which is what I want to kind of get to.
And I think the first thing that I just want to put out there, mm-hmm. in response to your question is, people often say in response to gentrification, well, the city's always been changing. Mm-hmm. And I think that is like a bit of a false statement.
It's a flattening device.
Yeah.
Meaning it distorts the way I saw it when you said that is like people say when they react to hearing about gentrification or, you know, the various inequalities that exist in New York. Well, New York is always changing. That doesn't really say anything. I mean, as a historian,
it stops conversation.
It's a conversation stopper.
Yeah, it's
like,
meant to.
Well, America has always changed. And we were kind of joking about like, oh, take that to the extreme, you know, we're going to start segregating people again. Well, things always change.
Right.
That doesn't really say anything.
Consciously or not, the person who says that doesn't want to have the conversation about gentrification, doesn't
right.
want to think about it. And I think, you know, and we can say this about any number of topics we've covered on this show. Mm-hmm. It's because a lot of people have a lot of feelings about these conversations, about these topics. And when people start to entertain feelings that are negative, like guilt or shame or the possibility of those feelings, whether or not they should even be feeling that, even the possibility, the specter of negative feelings leads to defensive reactions. And people just want to just move the conversation to another topic that, you know, produces positive feelings.
For those of you keeping track, Justin is engaging in what we might call affective discourse, meaning the discourse of affect.
Well,
meaning, and in just a very non-academic way, all that means is that emotions drive politics.
And this is a very emotional issue.
And how mm-hmm. people feel about things on a kind of visceral, emotional, sometimes even subconscious level, actually drives the kinds of political arguments they make and the kinds of ideologies that attract them. So mm-hmm. That's a really, really, I think for me, important thing. And often, you know, that kind of that idea of affective discourse is such a theoretical academic thing, but it doesn't have to be. That's
just
the thing.
It's an emotional conversation.
And I think everyone gets that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the people that run Fox News and not even just Fox News, but CNN, MSNBC, and corporate media, when they do that, they put screaming talking heads on TV. They know what they're doing.
Oh, yeah.
They're engaging in affective discourse too, because it's all emotion. I mean, Rush Limbaugh is a genius at this. He just hits the emotion over and over and over again.
Keith Olbermann too.
Yeah. No, you're right. Absolutely. Keith Olbermann hits the kind of emotion of the weepy weepy liberal.
Yeah. You know? Well, and that dude got angry too.
Edward R. Murrow.
Before he was kicked off.
Yeah. Kicked off MSNBC.
Yeah. Well, and one thing I just want to say is a rejoinder to those people that say, well, what do you mean the city hasn't always been changing? And I'll just say, listen, there's a big difference between if you look at the Lower East Side in 1885, mm-hmm. and you have a wave of, let's say, Polish and Italian immigrants that are coming in to work in textile factories or something, and they're occupying these tenement buildings. And then in the 1920s, another wave of immigrants comes in, moves into the neighborhood, as well as artists, as well as African-Americans. And all of a sudden, you have this kind of Creole mix in the East Village, kind of a, I'm romanticizing it just to make a point, which in the 1920s, now you have all these different ethnic groups. Now, what didn't happen between 1880s and the 1920s is we didn't see like a really significant influx of wealth. We saw a turnover of different kinds of ethnic groups, racial groups, and the kind of maybe emergence of a middle class where there was once kind of a really dirt poor working class. And maybe that is a class shift, but it's not extreme. And you could still find working class people in the East Village. Okay, now skip ahead to the 50s, skip ahead to the 1980s. And what you see transforming is a wave of small businesses that belong to different kinds of ethnic communities. So, for instance, one of the things that comes to my mind immediately is the Holiday Cocktail Lounge.
Yeah, I was hoping, yeah.
Bar we used to go to, you know, R.I.P., rest in peace. You know, before it was this bar, it was an Italian barbershop. And then it became a kind of working class, middle class bar. And then it got lost to this gentrification of the East Village that happened about, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, but had been happening in the East Village on St. Mark's, you know, for 15, 20, 25 years. And all I want to say in terms of the city always changing argument is there is a big difference between the turnover of one small business to another, where the income generated from that business is within a certain range, and the transformation of that space later into an elite sanctuary, a high-end restaurant, a big box retail store. And I think that if you look at the changes that have been happening in New York City for the last 25 years, and you look at the wave of gentrification, not change, but gentrification, the thing you start to see is that the change is one way. It's moving in one direction. And even though some of the gentrifiers in some of these neighborhoods where new people have been coming in are diverse and have remained diverse, and maybe there's a diverse wave of newcomers coming in from all over the world and from all over the United States, from all different kinds of ethnic and racial communities, fine. That is happening in certain places more than in others, and it's, you know, we can have a complex conversation about it. But at the same time, overall, there's no way to dispute that the changes are happening much more radically and in one direction, which is a corporate direction, a elite direction, a ruling class direction. The changes that are happening are not small business to small business.
Has walked through even, you know, Midtown Manhattan lately, this what you see is banks, mainly banks and Foot Lockers and corporate institutions, and that the I think Midtown has always had a certain kind of commercial flavor to it, but at the same time, it really feels when I think of Manhattan now, the Chase logo, the Chase logo is in my head because it feels like there's Chase Bank on every single
corner. It's an outdoor shopping mall, and that's a tired argument.
Yeah.
It's still a very valid one.
No, and so I thank you for making that and articulating that whole idea of saying that New York has always changed is both, you know, true in some kind of Pollyannish sense, but in reality, New York has been by saying that, you kind of stop the kind of analysis that you just did, which is actually looking at like, well, why is it changing and how is it changing?
Yeah, and
it's
not just change.
It's something that you can anthropologize. It's something that you can actually kind of take apart.
And without getting into any of the details now, I would say three things for people to consider are the things within New York City that have made this happen, which, you know, one thing would just be the expansion of Wall Street since 1980, the fact that this is a city in which you have the richest people in the United States and the richest corporations in the United States. They're all headquartered here.
Some of the richest in the world, in fact.
Absolutely. So things that have been happening inside New York would also be, you know, Giuliani's suburbanization of Times Square.
Yes. And people call it Disneyfication of Times Square.
Which is the Disneyfication of all of New York.
Yes.
Bloomberg falling on the heels after 9/11 saying, we want the city to remake its money and identity through tourism. And I read somewhere that there are now 50 million visitors to New York City every year.
Wow.
Bringing in tens of billions of dollars. And I'm neutral on that point for now, but I'm just saying that what that also points to is the changes being made inside New York by political and economic leaders are also causing changes to be made from a global perspective. So the other reason this is happening to New York is because of a global context, globalization. So that New York City is a global city. And before and after the financial collapse, New York City real estate was purchased by, you know, the transnational global 1% who buy properties here as an investment. I read in the past 6 months somewhere that since 2008, over 50% of all apartment and real estate sales in Manhattan are from global buyers. Mm. So that this is a city where everyone's priced out because the richest people from every country of the world buy property here as an investment.
And you know, this is what gets me to that, how unfortunately this has, this is a real problem. I mean, gentrification and globalization are actually, as I would, and I think you would too, kind of identify these as negative developments in human history, and particularly the history of New York City. But, and I think a lot of people feel that. I mean, I think we're framing it a certain way about like not liking Chase Banks, etc. But the way many New Yorkers are experiencing this are through, you know, rents that they can't afford, people being pushed out of neighborhoods, people not having jobs. I mean, really, obviously, again, the people at the bottom of the class structure are the ones that feel it the most. But what's unfortunate about how it's played out is that the people and the institutions that are driving gentrification, I think you agree are the same people that are driving globalization and they're financial institutions. We're talking about corporate and Wall Street scumbags, and they're the people that are driving this kind of negative thing that we're identifying and that most New Yorkers identify as negative. But yet, the conversation we're having is not about those corporate scumbags, is it? The conversation we're having is more about identity and about that kind of affective discourse that you're talking about. And what I mean is this Die Hipster blog, for instance, that's kind of you know, when you're talking about the Holiday Cocktail Lounge going away and being replaced by a Chase Bank, it wasn't a guy wearing skinny jeans and horn-rimmed glasses with a bunch of tattoos and a beard that made that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, that guy, that stereotyped image of the quote-unquote hipster, is carrying the weight of gentrification in a lot of ways.
That's true.
In a weird way.
And or she is carrying the symbolic weight.
Right, right.
Of all of gentrification.
And how can we talk about a way that kind of unpacks that? Because I think that there's something fair about it and completely unfair about it in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
There is a phenomenon that's identifiable. And I think that's what the argument we were having in the kitchen was kind of figuring out that we're kind of straddling these lines ourselves. That I'm looking at Justin across from me in his hoodie and his horn rimmed glasses and you know, people who have seen me, you know, I think they
understand. Beard and flannel.
Right. Yeah. And I think when people look at me walking down the street, that hipster is probably a word that comes to mind for a lot of people. And yet I don't feel like a gentrifier. I don't feel like a colonizer. I don't feel like I'm driving economic change in New York. In fact, I actually feel as much of a victim of it as a lot of people. But maybe that's not true. What do you think?
Well, I think the first thing it points to is we live in a complex economic ecosystem within the city, and that the people who create the spaces, by which I mean the bars, the restaurants, the social apartments,
the
people that create the social and residential spaces that from a top down
that we all
macro
share
scale,
and that's what maybe what New York makes this so brings this out so much, is that we're sharing these public spaces to a degree that you don't see in a lot of urban places.
Well, yeah, and that the creation of these spaces are driven by corporations, whether that's a combination of financial institutions and development institutions and landlord, conglomerates. But in other words, the change that's being planned and designed is being designed at the very high end, mostly for the very high end.
Mm.
And one of the things that we can talk about later is, you know, how little affordable housing has been built under Bloomberg and even under Giuliani, and also how, in tandem with this, we've seen the privatization of many public common spaces. So a quick example of that would be on my block in Crown Heights right now, there was a school that got like an F, you know, and then they closed the school. The school was raised and they're building a 15-story glass tower.
Wow.
On the graveside of a school. Now, I thought this might have been happening all over, and that question wasn't answered for me until this week when I realized that there's all these protests that are mobilizing around the closure of public libraries all around Brooklyn, and that Bloomberg has sold many of these libraries and is about to sell the rest to private development. The libraries will be raised and glass towers will be built. So they're actually defunding schools and libraries, killing these public sharing spaces, and then putting in private spaces. And I think that is kind of the trend that I want to latch onto, is the reason why gentrification matters so much is that there's not a parallel trend of the creation of public space. Mm. There's not a parallel trend where just because these private spaces are coming in, others public spaces are being created.
Right, right.
We're actually seeing only the privatization of space. And then that leaves fewer and fewer choices for people that don't have the same kinds of means, and fewer choices for people who are experiencing these high rents.
So this is seems like gentrification has a nice friend named austerity. Right?
Absolutely. And austerity has helped...
And what I mean by that is we're privatize the shit out of everything and take away the public. And so that metaphor, that's not even a metaphor, it's real. Just think of what Justin just said on his block in Crown Heights or near where he lives in Crown Heights, which is one of several ground zeros of gentrification, if you'll forgive that language. But but that the image that Justin just set up, I think, is worth repeating of a school being torn down in a community, replaced by a 15-story glass luxury apartment building that only people basically in the 1% can afford to live in, and that school is not moved or placed anywhere else. The school is just gone. That community doesn't have that school anymore. Yeah. So what have we done? We've taken something from the public that everyone was using and made it so that only a few people can use it. And it's these glass towers too. I don't want to get off topic, but yesterday when we were walking through Sunset Park, and I mentioned this in last week's episode with Claudia talking about New York, that One World Trade Center, speaking of ground zero, right? That One World Trade Center that we've watched be constructed over the last few years, doesn't it look like a globalized tower? Doesn't it look like something you'd see in Dubai? Mm-hmm. Like that kind of architecture, and it looks like a tower from Dubai. It looks like
one of the phallic fingers of global capital.
Yeah, yeah, and it looks like it has that kind of style. And there's something sinister looking about it. That tower, I'm not entirely comfortable with for probably a lot of different reasons. But I, in either case,
because it's at the very least, the architecture signals that the loyalties of the people in that building are elsewhere.
Yeah, and isn't that what the tower in Crown Heights symbolizes too, right? Mm-hmm. That those same people are living in these towers that look, it's not, in other words, it's not just One World Trade Center that looks like a globalized tower full of rich people. It's actually, they're springing up all over.
That's right.
And in fact, when we walk on St. Mark's in the Village, there's a big one, right? Right by that's gone up, that we've seen gone
that's
up
right.
at an astonishing pace.
East Village is amazing.
Yeah, every time we go down
there. Astor Place.
Yeah, Astor Place. Yeah. If you stand on Astor Place now, it's that cube has had a kind of like that cube at Astor Place has had a kind of historic resonance, a counterculture resonance, mm-hmm. a gateway to the counterculture. Mm-hmm. And if you stand on that traffic island with the cube structure now, you are surrounded by giant glass buildings that you're not allowed in. Right?
Absolutely.
Like, you are not allowed in
those
buildings.
That's true. You raise a great point. You know, and the counterpoint to the Astor Place thing is, or not the counterpoint, the example, it would be, there's a film, I think it's on Netflix, called Downtown 81, and it's a kind of weird, low-budget film about Basquiat,
yes.
starring him.
Yes, yeah.
And he walks around, and he pops up out of the 6th train's Astor Place stop, and the camera does a 360 at Astor Place in 1981.
And what does it look like?
Well, you know, there's no Starbucks. And remember the time when there were 3 Starbucks at that corner?
Yes.
And then that shifted when Barnes & Noble left out and the other Starbucks went away for that glass tower. But, it, you know, the Cooper Union building is there. And most, I got to be honest, I think everything else is boarded up. But it's a completely different kind of vibe.
There's graffiti everywhere.
There's
trash everywhere. And there's the heart of it, right?
Yep.
We're romanticizing a little bit ourselves.
Yeah.
Which is that there's this kind of... That was the gritty, real New York was the 80s, but that's also what we, you know, Claudia and I talked about this yesterday with, you know, in talking about our different fantasies about the city and both Los Angeles and New York growing up. And when I was a kid, and I think you would agree, didn't you think of New York as a gritty and scary place? Didn't that graffiti place? I mean, you know, there is a certain level of romanticization.
Seinfeld did a lot to domesticate it, though, for
right,
me.
Right. Well, that came up too with Claudia, because Seinfeld definitely like made this, like presented this clean. But that's 90s New York. You know what I mean? It's weird to romanticize an authentic New York that was a New York that people were suffering tremendously in. Like the 1980s
Absolutely.
Were not a wonderful time to be in New York. And I'm not talking about crime necessarily. I'm talking mainly about the economy. Like people were, it was bad. It was not a fun place to
be.
There is a kind of weird nostalgia for it in the face of this kind of hyper glossy corporate globalized city that it's becoming. Mm-hmm. And when I say globalized, I don't mean there's a lot of diverse people here. I mean globalized in that the financial institutions and the people that are running this city are the heads of multinational corporations.
Well, and let's think about what, no matter how bad it was in the 80s, you could live in Manhattan as an artist, as a writer, as a student, as a barber, as a bartender, you know, as a waiter, and you could have a nice life. You know, nice in quotes, but I'm just saying you could live there and afford it. And that's utterly impossible.
There was more access.
There was access and opportunity. Mm. And so when we talk about like the American dream, you know, what is it? Well, almost no one I know will say the United States is a country that should guarantee everyone's success. You know, I don't know anyone who believes that, but everyone says, particularly liberals, that America is a place that should guarantee everyone's opportunity. Mm. And New York City is not a place that guarantees everyone's opportunity.
But it never has. But I think what you're saying is that there's been a significant constriction in that mm-hmm. level of access since this 1980s period.
There's less possibility.
Can I be the devil's advocate for a second?
I hope so.
And let you respond to it. Can I be like the stereotypical kind of young white suburban person that grew up, you know, in the 80s and 90s, looking at New York and says, I love New York now because of the New York of the 1980s. I would have never moved there because it was so gritty and dangerous. But now, since Giuliani, since Bloomberg, we have a much nicer city. Crime has dropped tremendously. There used to be between 500 and 700 murders a year, something like
more than that, yeah. More than 2,000.
Really, really. During the late 70s and early 80s, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you're talking about, you know, I will take the glossy towers. I will take the Chase Banks as long as it feels safe and mm-hmm. it's a great city for me to live in and bring my parents to come visit. And what are you talking about, Justin?
Mm-hmm.
What?
I'd say, look, you've named so many terrific things about the city's changes, you know, and why even have this conversation unless we're going to acknowledge that,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's undeniable. And maybe a lot of the opportunities that even I've encountered here in the city as someone who's lived here for 9 or 10 years, going to school, getting a job, you know, maybe the city as it stands now is the city that gave me those chances, and that city would not have given me those chances back in the day. Fine, I take your point. It's a great point. The thing that I would still point to as part of this other parallel conversation is that, you know, the city should be a place where everyone has the right to be there in all the different spaces, you know, and that includes, you know, we should have had the right to be in Alphabet City in 1981 when it was, you know, a, you know, put it in quotes, a crime infested drug den. You
yes,
know what I mean?
A junkie's ghetto.
Yeah. I'm not sure I would have been welcome there,
yes,
you know, and
right. filled with shooting galleries and the streets running with blood and vomit and heroin needles.
Yeah. It's undeniable. And so I think that what we're still pointing to is, we still want the city to be a place where people who are born here and grew up here have the same opportunities as anyone else. And I still think that part of what we're seeing with the changes that have happened is something that's excessive. It's overboard. It's hyper gentrification. It's not just that the city has been quote unquote cleaned up. It's come in the wake of stop and frisk, so that like you have this tremendous excess taken by the NYPD, that the kinds of policies that have enacted these opportunities for some have been directly linked to policies that have denied hundreds of thousands of people.
Yes, but that's exactly the argument that pro stop and frisk people make, and that was stop and frisk is just one policy that I would say has been cited as one of the most effective things in cleaning up the streets has been, you know, unfortunately we have to use unconstitutional methods, but that's the price we pay for cleaning up New York.
No, you know, here's the price you pay. Start producing opportunities for people in those neighborhoods.
Mm.
And, you know, in other words, the solution to crime is not to imprison people. The solution to crime is to take away the conditions that produce crime in the first place. That is why stop and frisk has been ineffective, in that if it was an effective policy, at the end of 10 years, there'd be no one to frisk because crime has disappeared. All you're doing is incarcerating people. And you can't just continue to keep incarcerating people because then the price is paid out on the prison end in taxpayer dollars, and the price is paid out in hundreds of thousands of people's lives who've been shredded.
Yes.
Those lives they can't get back. Charges of, you know, all kinds of heinous charges and resentments and emotional resentments.
Well, you know, that the prison system, as you know, is, and the criminal justice system is quite profitable for the same institutions that are gentrifying, which is kind of, you know, gets you into some very uncomfortable and almost conspiracy level territory that isn't that isn't conspiracy at all. I mean,
there's no conspiracy.
Yeah, this is again, you know, that conspiracy word is often used to discourage any kind of institutional analysis, really.
It's, you know, the city's always changing statement.
Right, yeah, the city's always changing. So that, but what you're hitting on is this really very disturbing thought that the people that are profiting from putting up luxury apartments are kind of involved in imprisoning the population that's already living
there. So let's be clear to that person who says, this is the city I'd rather be living in. Okay, the reason the city is different now rather than the 1980s is not because the sources of the crime in the 1980s has been eliminated. The people who were suffering and then were growing up in conditions that led to crime, the sociological reasons that produced crime, those neighborhoods were eradicated, and many of those people were imprisoned and had to leave. And the people in the neighborhoods that are left don't have the same kind of opportunities. And in other words, what you're saying is the success of New York in the last 30 years has been built on the back of people who have not enjoyed it, that a large section of the population has had to be sacrificed.
Yes.
For the pleasure zone.
And a population that has historically been sacrificed.
And if you're not able to walk from school to your apartment in your own neighborhood, you've denied people not only the right to travel to another area of the city, like Times Square, these, you know, tourist zones. You're saying that you don't have the right to walk down the street in your own neighborhood. And that's, aside from the questions of constitutionality, it's unquestionably unconstitutional. When Michelle Alexander writes in The New Jim Crow, there are more black men incarcerated now than there were slaves in 1860.
Mm-hmm.
What we're talking about then is that it is impossible to divorce a conversation about hipsterism and gentrification from acknowledging New York City is the capital of the new Jim Crow.
Very nice.
And once you have that on the map, it means we can't have this conversation without entertaining some really hardcore subjects.
Yeah, right.
And we have to at least acknowledge those subjects as we move forward.
So you have this this segregation taking place on a mass scale in New York, and so maybe, you know, the word gentrification might be better served as segregation. But either way, this idea of taking away the school intrigues me because, you know, I often explain to my students or try to explain to them about the impulse to educate the working class. Public education was developed in the 19th century, right? And, you know,
Reconstruction.
Yeah, and we just read a chapter from Howard Zinn that was attacking that, because Zinn has a very anti-capitalist kind of perspective on it, and he thinks public education is was basically indoctrination for factory life, and that the development of universal public education was actually a training ground for capitalism that trained the working class to regiment their lives with a bell every morning and separate their lives.
My dad always told me that.
Right. So there's that angle on it, but I try to focus on another angle of public education. Let me just take the other position, which is when I think about, why would this ruling class that is only interested in its own enrichment and has been willing to enslave people, why would they, out of the goodness of their own hearts, create a public education system for all those working class slobs that they have nothing but disdain for? But the answer is, and what I always understood to be the answer, is that the ruling class began the project of public education partly as a defensive maneuver, meaning that the idea that of having an underclass, a giant uneducated underclass, is unsustainable socially. Meaning
1877 railroad strikes.
Right, you'll have a revolution if you have just a completely ignorant mm-hmm. underclass toiling mm-hmm. away from you, and that's all there is. In other words, this is before the development of a strong middle class that becomes the progressives in the 19-teens mm-hmm. And earlier. But before the development of that middle class, or before the development of a solid middle class, there was this feeling that the working class, we better do something with them, because if we keep them all stupid, and literally the society is like, and I'm exaggerating, but it's five rich families. And maybe I'm not exaggerating. Five rich families and millions of poor ones. That's not going to last.
It's not sustainable.
No.
Well,
okay. So then what my question is, let's flash forward from the 19th century to 2013. What the hell is the idea of the ruling class in taking away that school and replacing it with a luxury apartment building? What are they thinking? Is there going to be a snapback from this? Or is it this level, this attack on public education, it sometimes baffles me. Because that danger is still there as far as I see it. Like the more you take away public education, the more you're making it possible for collapse and revolution to take place.
Yeah, I agree.
And that's oversimplifying.
No, it's not. I'd say the university and the education system is very complex, and that it's not only a place to train people, it's a place to warehouse people. For instance, the way that people choose to go into graduate school and master's programs because there aren't jobs. That's a plan.
That would be certainly my strategy for going to graduate school.
That's right. So like, schools are institutions to warehouse people for the possibility of employment or for the possibility of incarceration.
I'm a middle class white dude, and the best job that I could get 3 years out of graduating from a good school in California with an undergraduate bachelor's degree. 3 or 4 years after that, I was waiting tables, and it was the best thing I could do. And I had tried many, many different things. Maybe I was talentless at getting jobs. But either way,
the libertarian would say, you should have started your own business, asshole. Where's your entrepreneurial spirit?
I should have started that laundromat or pizza. I didn't have the capital, Justin.
Should have got a loan, man.
Yeah. There's loans. There's ways to do this. Not everyone can be a small business person, right? But either way, you're right. Graduate school was a place to absorb me. In mm-hmm. other words, it was a place for the state to absorb me, because otherwise, what the hell was I gonna do?
But the things we are doing in education and the things that happen in K-12 education are, in fact, things that are outside the state's control. So, I mean, in other words, the state, in quotes, isn't an institution with omnipotent power that can control every little room and every little nook and cranny. It's also to their advantage to have, people who are freely thinking on any number of levels in those spaces, because they understand that in order for them to maintain dominance, they have to be able to absorb and create new ideas and interesting perspectives. So actually, it's really weird that there has to be a space within the university and within the education system as a whole for real learning and real thinking to take place. Because without real thinking, our system will go into collapse. And this is part of the larger thing that you're raising, which I completely agree with, which is attacking public education is insane because it is unsustainable, both from a riot perspective or a revolutionary perspective, but also because of the all those statistics that people cite where, the U.S. is last among the advanced countries in math. It's last among the advanced countries in science. We're attacking the source.
We're giving up on all that.
Yeah, and the elite.
And that's what I wonder is why.
The
why?
Elite is attacking the source of its own wealth.
Yeah.
And that's what I don't understand that either.
Maybe it's an expression of the multinational and globalized kind of structure of things that we kind of have this wrong-headed idea that it's American companies that control the world right now, but that it's
they're multinationals.
Yeah, they're multinationals.
No loyalty.
Loyalties
are elsewhere.
So the idea of building the American project is kind of left to, I don't know who, left, maybe it's up for grabs. Maybe it's more up for grabs
it's
now than ever
before.
It's definitely
up for grabs. I completely agree.
There's no one driving the ship right now. I mean, I really feel that way. If you're looking to Obama to be the kind of ideological core.
Everyone realizes
core,
that now.
Everyone, Justin? I think there are many people who are big fans of the dude.
I was at a meeting yesterday.
Yeah.
MoveOn.org. Mm-hmm. me and my buddy Reed were there representing Move to Amend. This is the New York chapter, the New York affiliate that's trying to overturn Citizens United and erase corporate personhood. And based on the conversations that I heard, a lot of the women who showed up to this meeting were saying, voted for Obama in 2008, voted again, severely disappointed, and the breaking point was the cut to Social Security.
Which just happened this week.
Just happened.
I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, we're moving far from hipsters, but maybe we're not because it's, and I want to get back to,
we should
get back to that. But you know, hipster and the Obama hipster is certainly a phenomenon. But the idea that this week, a Democratic president touched the third rail of American politics, which is cutting Social Security. And that, to me, is so extraordinary and such a moment worth everybody considering. And yet, it kind of got lost. And I had a kind of very sarcastic Facebook status the other day because I was so enraged at the fact that the front page of the New York Times had nothing on it. Even they reported on it initially, and then it's kind of buried. Obama's budget kind of thing is on the third page. And North Korea is dominating the headlines, especially on these, you know.
That's not a coincidence.
My Facebook status was just kind of like, you know, look into the eyes of North Korea while we steal your Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
And again, conspiracy theory, right? But at the same time, the corporate media.
The smoking gun of the mushroom cloud.
Right, but the corporate media is 100% profiting off the idea of cutting Social Security.
Yeah.
And so you know, look into the eyes of North Korea is actually a strategy for them to survive.
So let's get into
and them
the,
to profit.
Let's get into the politics of Obama as the hipster president.
Yeah.
You know, with the t-shirts and all that kind of stuff. And let's just talk about
he wears a skinny suit.
Yeah, let's talk about the stereotype of the hipster's politics. So, like, if we're going to go into the stereotype of the hipster, the hipster is a liberal. You know, the hipster votes Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the hipster, taking all the fashion and all that stuff, you know, I guess that's a conversation we can have about, like, the floating signifier of the hipster, that someone who wears the get-up in one neighborhood isn't a hipster.
Mm-hmm.
Put them in another neighborhood and they are, which means the thing that we are calling the hipster is a shape-changing, shape-shifting thing.
Yes.
But, you know, here's the politics. The reason why these folk, the hipster, get personified as the agents of these corporate capitalists, and the reason why they take a lot of venom from and get a lot of resentment projected onto them is in part because of things that they are and things that actually they just seem to be.
Yeah.
So
they're easy stand-ins for.
Yeah, they're easy stand-ins, but, you know,
for attitudes or.
Yeah, and here's the thing is. Here's the devil's advocate argument. Okay, what about the hipster who comes to the community? And I'm actually thinking of myself here, to the extent that I'm a hipster and participating in Crown Heights gentrification.
You're one of the good ones.
That's what we like to say. Yeah. Well, maybe I'm not. Maybe I am. But, like, you know, I'm involved with a group called Crow Hill Community Association, and we're talking with the city right now about landmarking certain buildings in the neighborhood. We're talking about initiating the conversation about rezoning so that we can get people from the community to have a voice about the future of the neighborhood and about preventing the kinds of really predatory development.
Yeah, and I think that's what happening. When we hear resentment about hipsters, and I've certainly heard it from many different angles, actually, and mm-hmm. often from hipsters themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But the disdain or the feeling is again, hipsters are kind of unfairly been or they're the face of gentrification, mm-hmm. right? And so, fair or not, that's what has happened. But the idea is that. The resentment comes because there's the feeling that these gentrifiers are coming to communities and not really engaging with those communities.
There's no exchange.
There's no exchange. They're there to just kind of, you know, put their make the community into their image.
They're colonizers.
Yes. Here's the bar that plays indie rock. The coffee shop. Here's the yoga place. Here's the bicycle store.
Mm-hmm.
And
here's my culture.
Yeah, here's my culture.
And
automatically assuming that culture is improving the neighborhood. And so, you know, that's maybe a larger argument to have. But I think what you're saying is that there is a way to live in these neighborhoods, be a quote unquote hipster, whatever that means, and not be the odious gentrifier mm-hmm. that has come to rape and pillage the community, but instead as someone that's actively trying to engage in those economic concerns that everybody shares, right?
Yeah. Are you going to come to a neighborhood and participate in social life that is diverse, that engages the diversity, that engages even long-term residents? And, you know, are you going to be someone who segregates yourself, self-segregates yourself, and isn't just simply isn't interested in other kinds of cultures? And the thing is, I think that for the people who come to new neighborhoods and open up businesses and socialize among longtime residents who they don't choose to get to know, I think that is a problem. And I think that's a problem everywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think we can look at the problem from the reverse angle, which is
that's why and so in other words, the resentment that that is being expressed towards hipsters is the same resentment that you would find in a lot of places.
That's right.
About the newcomer.
That's right.
Or the interloper.
One thing I've been thinking about is Spike Lee's film Do the Right Thing, the Brooklyn of the 80s. Mm-hmm. Well, what's interesting about the film is the tensions are between African Americans and Italians.
Yes.
And African Americans and I think it was Koreans or a group of Asian Americans who opened up those small businesses.
Uh-huh.
And back then, it was kind of like, well, those are the tensions that are being created. It's a different kind of racial ethnic politics mm-hmm. in play. And it's a different kind of class politics in play because it's kind of like, well, you can't really accuse this Asian American deli owner of being an elite predatory person. And at the same time, there are class politics in play there.
Yeah, right. The great scene that I'm thinking about in Do the Right Thing is Mookie, is the character played by Spike Lee, is a delivery boy for, or a delivery guy for Sal's Pizzeria, Danny Aiello. And there's a group of young black kids that come into the pizza place, and they ask, why are all the pictures on the wall of these Italian heroes like Frank Sinatra and things mm-hmm. like that? And they were saying, you know, why isn't our culture reflected? This is a black neighborhood, and that is so complicated.
Yeah.
That's why I think like Spike Lee created a very difficult movie and a complicated one, probably one of the more complicated mainstream movies about race I've ever seen.
Absolutely.
There's not one. And when you're watching that movie, it's a perfect one to start a discussion in a class, right? Because when you're watching that movie, you can show a scene and then ask students what happened in this scene, and everyone is going to have a very dramatically different interpretation.
And so, you know,
are still playing out today,
right?
With
and
hipsters.
What are the texts now that are the Do the Right Things of 2013, 2012, 2011, 2010? Mm-hmm. You know. How are we having this conversation? How is it being structured? And in my own neighborhood, for instance, a Little Zelda's coffee shop, and this is a big blogging thing, took away a parking spot, got permission. So I guess transformed.
Is Little Zelda's a hipster?
I mean, yeah, it's a hipster coffee shop.
Coffee shop?
Do
you have to register? There's a registration that's like says, you know, what kind of coffee shop is it? And like hipster. That's
yeah. And it's a nice place.
It's named after it's named after F. Scott Fitzgerald's wife, for Christ's sake. So
there you go.
We know what it is.
There you go. The parking spot in front was transformed into a bike rack. And this shows up in the New York Times. You can Google this. And the longstanding residents of the community, and they were pretty much people of color for the most part, were kind of outraged that they weren't consulted. This bike rack came to symbolize all the problems with gentrification. And so this group that I am, you know, involved with, the Crow Hill Community Association, in the context of all these conversations about landmarking and rezoning, they have this huge meeting in which a lot of residents came from all different sides of the issue and shared their visions of the future, but also their grievances. And, you know, for me, this has been a really substantive way to participate in these discussions with my neighbors, who I'm not sure I would have had the context or the institutional support for. I wouldn't have known how to find the forum for this. It's been a great forum for having that Spike Lee conversation with actual people. I go around advertising for this stuff. I stood by the subway yesterday, advertising our next meeting. I encountered so many different people, and it gave me a really vital opportunity to shake hands with people, to meet residents from the community. And it feels so good because I feel like we're participating, we're exchanging. And
does it feel radical or liberal to you, what's going on there? You know what I mean? Like what?
I'd say both.
Yeah.
I'd say both. And it depends on your perspective.
It's weird because, you know, when we often come, I think we often attack liberals from the left. That seems to be a mode that I'm often in, and at the same time, I think that's what there's a certain amount of kind of like, come on, liberals, you know, you're right, but you need to just take it a little bit further. In other words, it's not like we're on the right wing and saying like, oh, you know, you guys are completely wrong about everything. I think we recognize in liberals a certain kind of humanistic tendency that we want to exploit and kind of convince needs to move further. And I don't mean necessarily into any kind of socialism or anarchy or any particular structured ideology that Justin and I share. I think, you know, if I had to describe my politics, I don't know what I would say. You know, I would definitely Occupy Wall Street would be in there, in the sense that I think there needs to be a much more radical engagement with stopping the direction that this country is going. I'm not with the everything's always changing crowd, despite having thrown that at you at the beginning of today's episode.
Well, here's what I'll say. Here's some of the things that have surprised me. And here's why it probably is liberal. The people in the community, the longstanding residents, people of color, for the most part, many are already homeowners. Many want to see further gentrification. Many like the gentrification that's happened. Many have opened small businesses. There's one that
you're characterizing liberal as pro-gentrification.
To a certain extent, yes. And so that
at the same time, hand-wringing about it sometimes.
Yeah, in other words, what actually is taking place is a lot of members of, you know, it's mostly a West Indian neighborhood in terms of the people of color. So a lot of people of color and these kind of, I don't know what you would call it, like white community activists like myself, have found a lot of common ground. Mm-hmm. But the people that have found the most common ground are the people that are interested in... who are able to take advantage of the economic opportunities. And then the people that are really kind of angry, and I don't know if I fit in or where I would fit into this part, are the people that don't have opportunities, whose choices are being limited by these changes.
I like that idea of opportunity because, you know, you like to quote Rahm Emanuel, right? Saying that, you know, never let a good crisis go to waste. Is that right?
Yeah.
But this came up on the when Luke and Mikhail and I were talking about technology and education a couple weeks ago, the austerity. Luke likes to frame it, and I like the way he frames it as an opportunity for educators to get their voices in some way. In other words, the crisis of gentrification, in the same way, can be seen not just as an opportunity for the forces of gentrification, but an opportunity to force a larger conversation.
Yeah,
you know, an opportunity to get to change the community.
And we've mobilized, we're directing the future. You know, we're not gonna have the final word.
Yeah,
but we've gone to the city, and they know they have to deal with us, and the route to development must go through the Crow Hill Community Association. This is democracy.
Well, yeah, and
at the local level,
there are inspiring wins, and you know, I want to mention really quickly that the chancellor of the City University of New York resigned this week. Matthew Goldstein, who's New York, big news in the New York Times. And for those that aren't in a higher education in New York and aren't part of CUNY, you might not know that there's been a major austerity battle going on in CUNY for the last several years. Matthew Goldstein has created a series of very aggressive policies, particularly one, the most unpopular has been lately called Pathways. Either way, I'm not going to get into all of that, but faculty throughout many schools at CUNY have been organizing against it, have been resisting it, and it felt like for the last year, the anti-pathway stuff has felt hopeless. It just felt like the administration is going to run over us. It's still unclear what's going to happen with it, but the fact that Goldstein resigned was just like, wow. There's some inspiration there. It feels like a victory. I don't know if Pathways where it's going to go. But at the same time, it feels like, in other words, the activism that you're talking about, the Crow Hill thing, it has an impact in ways that are surprising. And as someone who you know, studies the 60s and studies the anti-war movement and the various social movements in the 1960s, people often have a very defeatist attitude about the anti-war movement, that like everything we did didn't mean shit. They killed 3.5 million Vietnamese anyway. But at the same time, I think these things have impacts that we can't necessarily... In other words, it's not a one-to-one.
Mm-hmm.
You don't necessarily go to a place and say, stop the war, and the war stops. But your activity and your activism and your voice does make an impact somewhere along the line, does actually, you throw enough rocks at something moving and it's gonna divert its path just a little bit. And if you have enough people diverting that path, then we see historical change in a direction that we would like it to go.
Yeah, and I think one of the morals of the story is...
Sorry, I didn't mean to be all inspiring there. I love that. Jesus, I'm not usually like that. I sound like a liberal, actually.
No,
segregation, man.
No. But I think what that inspires me to think is, one of the things we need to do in neighborhoods all across New York City right now is to help produce culture with our neighbors and not produce culture just for our friends.
Not be that stereotype. And not just consume.
Yeah. You just can't consume a neighborhood. And you can't pretend that when you walk down Franklin Avenue, if you're someone in my neighborhood, that all these little shops and all these little restaurants and all these little bars and all these little coffee shops, they're just there for you to enjoy. You know, that there's a larger purpose to our identity as New Yorkers.
Right.
There's a larger purpose to our identity as Americans and as global citizens, whatever you want to say. And we're supposed to meet each other and find ways to make things together and to imagine not how we can just enjoy our lives, but also to imagine how we can expand the opportunities of enjoyment for others and to work with people to expand those opportunities and make those opportunities possible and make, you know,
form new cultures
to form a new future.
Separateness.
That's what
the American project in a positive way has been about, right? Has been taking that separateness and creating a whole lot of it. Marx would
and look
that.
At the 60s. That's the inspiring message. You know, look at all the coalitions that were built.
Yeah.
You know, I think that if all we're doing on the weekends is consuming and drinking, that's not going to make a coalition.
No.
You know, and I think that in the ways that...
Brunching every Sunday.
That's right. And, you know, just like you talked about the education system, you know, the assault on education is going to blow back on New York and the United States in ways that we can't expect. But it will blow back. And it already has.
Yeah.
If all you're doing is consuming...
people to put in prison.
And you actually...
more people to force into the military.
That's right. And you live in New York as if it really is your Disneyland. Like Brooklyn, Crown Heights, Park Slope. This is your Disney World, and you're just here to enjoy... It'll come back, and we need to work together to make sure.
I would, even if it doesn't come back in a kind of collapse scenario, or come back in a larger kind of economic way. I'm the kind of person that thinks it comes back karmically. You know, I'm the kind of person that thinks that the groups that just extract are the groups are the people that pay the heaviest karmic tolls, and a part of me has to believe that. And that's maybe a larger conversation. But before we're done, I did want to mention Portlandia. I really wanted to hear your take on Portlandia, because I've seen a few conversations on Portlandia about what it is, what that show is, and I have to say I've only seen it a couple times. I'm not a huge fan of the show, and partially because of the politics of it. There are some that think that the show represents an attack on hipsters. I mean, this is kind of what we're talking about today, an attack on the kind of politics of hipsters. And some people think that it's kind of attacking liberalism from the left. But I feel that the show is actually a liberal attack on radical politics. Then the example I had with one of the episodes I watched was just making fun of people that kind of eat artisanal foods and go find. Or organic chicken farm,
or like the feminist bookseller.
Yeah, right. And I get that there's kind of a surrealism to the show. There's kind of a wackiness, and I don't want to act like a hyper serious academic. That is not funny, and I don't find that amusing. Yeah. But at the same time, I kind of was just so pissed off at the shit I saw on that show that I was kind of like that. This show is the gentrifying liberal that wants to just enjoy shit in the neighborhood and laugh at the people that take themselves too seriously and actually laugh at activism. Like, I feel like Portlandia
and laugh at earnestness.
Yeah, let's make fun of. Is Portlandia going to do a show about making fun of unions? You know, are they going to make?
Probably.
Are they going to do a show? I feel like they would do a show coming to the Crow Hill community organization that you're talking about, and they would do a show making fun of how stupid it is to try and stop gentrification. Oh, you're an anti-gentrification activist. How surprising. You know, and then use all that identity stuff about glasses and tattoos or whatever to attack that, and I just don't like. I feel like that show really does represent liberals trying to put really put an end to things that represent somewhat positive developments in culture.
I agree.
It's, in other words, it's like really easy to shit on vegans and food politics mm-hmm. people, but at the same time, it's like, what are you suggesting, that we all just eat factory food? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah,
because
that's the problem with satire. You know, there's nothing offered in return.
Right. And I get that there are things that are about hipsterism, including veganism and everything, that are, you know, worthy of satire, and they're kind of ripe for parody. I get that. I really do. And certainly when I'm walking around Park Slope on the weekends, looking at the crowds of hipsters waiting for brunch, oftentimes I engage in that kind of like, oh, Jesus Christ, look at these people.
It's an easy thing to stereotype and project on.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm definitely guilty of that too. And maybe that's why I don't like Portlandia and its attitude, because it kind of echoes an attitude in myself that I don't want to have. Right, mm-hmm. I don't want to be making fun of the guy that's farming on the roof. I want to be with that guy. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I don't want to make fun of the girl who's a feminist. Like, I want to learn from her, yeah. and I want to engage in.
Why are we shutting these people out?
Right.
And I think it's about liberal norms.
Yeah.
I think Tina Fey is really good at this with uh-huh. 30 Rock. Yeah. That show's about liberal norms too. Uh-huh. It's just about
And Alec Baldwin plays the one percenter.
Yeah.
Right.
Who's actually adorable and lovable.
Right.
You know? And like, fine. Yeah. You know, the one percenter is adorable and lovable, probably. You know? And it's the position that's monstrous.
Americans are very much in love with the 1% in a lot of ways.
In a lot of ways. But like, you know, just to go back to the Portlandia, you know, the stereotype they're working off of is that, like, the vegan is angry, the radical feminist is angry, and that they're also stupid, you know, and that they are kind of have a myopic sense of self, and that they're
hypocrites.
They lack self-consciousness. They're hypocrites. And
it's like, oh, you're at Occupy Wall Street, but you use a computer, don't you? Hypocrite.
Yeah,
therefore, I should not listen to any of your politics whatsoever because you use an Apple computer.
Yep.
And it's like, is that really where we're at?
Well,
it's like employing that sellout shit in a reverse way that really, like, you're right, it shuts down the conversation.
Right, and that's what that's the joke of Portlandia is. The joke is we're shutting this down.
Yeah.
The joke is we're shutting this down. And then the question, then you could psychoanalyze these comedians and say, why have they invested all of their career in shutting this down? Another tack to take is, look at that generation of SNL comedians.
Mm.
They're not nearly as radical in many ways as like the original generation. Mm. They're corporate SNL. And
yes.
So like they have to shut the radical stuff down.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, they are like kind of New York City elite cultural makers, and they're not really interested, many of them, I'm painting with a large brush here,
yes,
in discovering you know, real forms of, you know, really intense satire. Like, imagine the things that you could be making fun of and the so-called truths you could be exploding.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, they're working off of cliches and stereotypes. I'm not even sure that they're real.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people, you know, when Ani and I were experimenting with our vegan diet, a lot of people were like, we're so glad you're not proselytizing.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, well, you know, thank you. You know, I'm not going to go here right. And like shove my diet around. A lot of people think that that's like the stereotypical vegetarian vegan or something is someone who like goes around producing shame and guilt.
Yeah, right.
And it's like, I get that. That's a conversation to have. But at the same time, where did that stereotype come from? And also, you know,
Portlandia and places
like
that.
And also, like, what do you do with people who really are upset about things that they perceive to be wrong? And like, I think that's what Portlandia gets is, you know, are we in our culture, are we allowed to earnestly emote over issues that are close to our heart?
No. Portlandia really feels like, think about the intended audience for the show. The intended audience is not right-wingers. The intended audience is liberals themselves.
Self-congratulating liberals.
Yeah, self-congratulating liberals that are like, thank God I'm not a crazy vegan. Thank yep. God I'm not a crazy feminist.
Thank God I'm
not a radical. I'm not an Occupy Wall Street
I listen
person.
To radio shows like this.
Yes,
where
right.
What matters is the tone.
Mm.
And what matters is that we just take a particular stand on an issue. And
we're very moderate here.
We're very
NPR,
moderate. Yeah. We're very moderate because, you know, to have an extreme position on anything is itself a problem. And what's reasonable and what's intelligent is actually to be a centrist.
Mm.
That centrism is intelligence.
Yeah.
And centrism is reason.
God, it's like Fred Armisen is in the room with us. Actually, I would be curious to know what this guy thinks about this stuff, because, you know, that's what's weird about it, is it feels like a kind
of... He would make the fun of us in ways that I would probably laugh at.
Yeah, if... Yeah,
you know, congratulations already.
Yeah, great.
However, you know, what's the your honest response?
It feels like an actual check from within the liberal community. That's what Portlandia functions as mm-hmm. for me. I do not agree, and I do not see Portlandia as a radical show that's attacking...
Far from
liberals.
It.
It's attacking... It's attacking radical politics. It's attacking some of those hallmarks, and that's what you know. I feel that larger stereotyping about you know, people who shop at Whole Foods or whatever is really attacking some or oversimplifying a very complicated problem, right?
Well, yeah,
and Portlandia, you know, whatever. It's not destroying the world. You know, I don't want to make
No. I stopped watching because it's kind of like, who cares?
It's a silly, you know? Yeah. It's a silly. Silly show. But I did want to bring it up because I think it's in some ways it's the first like mainstream cultural production that I've seen that's kind of engaging in a conversation about this group that we're talking about. And again, it's a you know, we're talking about an image. We're talking about a kind of a media production. Wow. We're not talking about real people.
You know what?
Yep. Yeah, go ahead.
You know what you just inspired me to think is really the way to get through the future is going to just to move past the container conversation about hipster. Every time we talk about hipsterism, we're putting our thoughts and conversation into a container mm-hmm. about is he this, is she that? What is the right, you know?
And it's actually a conversation that's almost exclusively yeah. taking place within that community. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like the
it's more navel gazing.
If you talk about hipsters, you are a hipster in a sense. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, at a certain point, and yeah, including the angry dude,
right?
You know,
right?
Who? So I think, you know, what we really have to do is find a way to, when we have the conversation about the hipster, and hopefully we've achieved that a little bit in this show,
mm-hmm.
is about having a conversation about pushing the conversation back to the issues. That really need to be talked about.
You know? Yeah. And so when that word comes up, hipster, I think that what I want to do is challenge people to, when they engage in that discourse, to define, what are you talking about when you say hipster?
And
what do you mean?
What is this conversation going to produce?
And if they can't talk about anything beyond cultural identity signifiers like horn-rimmed glasses, tattoos, and veganism, then I know that they're not really... serious about having a conversation about what the society is, because
is that the fashion police?
It's weird.
That is weird.
It's really weird.
We really resent the glasses. Well, why are you obsessed with these glasses?
Because the glasses are an icon that have again become a shorthand signifier for gentrification and all these other things that are not necessarily connected. I think it's incredibly complicated. And as someone who again kind of straddles the line between a hipster and you know, just working class dude, you have it's something that needs to be spoken about in a way that's more complex and that reflects those complexities, because like you said, you know, you see that iconography of hipster, but you go talking to that person mm-hmm. and the stereotype falls apart.
What an irony that in a culture of just vast inequality, where corporate predators are really the source and origin of so many problems, people attack the horn-rimmed glasses because, in a weird way, they are unable to attack the real agent of power, which is the corporation.
Well, from the right wing, that attack, I think, of horn-rimmed glasses is often intellectual, Jew, gay. Like
East Coast elite.
Yeah, those are the things. And I would also like to before we go, I point out that, you know, it's kind of weird to be like, oh, I'm being stereotyped as a white guy. When these kinds of stereotypes, like the black community that we're talking about, these neighborhoods that are like Crown Heights, those stereotypes are have functioned historically in a much more aggressive way of the like, you know, you talk about horn-rimmed glasses, but think about like hip hop clothes, you know, mm-hmm. and like seeing a black guy in hip hop clothes I think that community has been derided and stereotyped in a much more devastating way than the white hipster. So I don't want to victimize the white hipster on this episode. I kind of want to make it clear that the white hipster is an amorphous category and maybe ineffective for talking about the larger issues that we're trying to get at.
Yeah,
fair.
Yeah, and it's also fair that if I went up and talked to some guy in tight jeans and horn-rimmed glasses of whatever ethnicity or sexuality, and his basic approach to life was, you know, I'm working to make money. I'm just here to party and have fun. I'd have a problem with that person.
Really?
I'm just working to make money and I'm here to have fun.
Working to make money and why? Well, I mean, that's what every American is doing though, right? I mean, in a weird way. I mean, I get what you're saying.
Dude, I'm falling in line behind people like Martin Luther King here. Yeah, Malcolm X. We have got to have a higher purpose to our existence. Yeah,
if you don't engage with what's around you and you're just like, I'm working to make money. Okay. Yeah, no, I understand.
I'm making money. I'm trying to have fun too. But I'm just saying, if at the end of the day, we're just here taking care of ourselves.
Yeah, no, I understand. And especially when you're talking about that skinny jean dude, the kind of poltergeist or scapegoat or straw man that we're creating, and him saying I'm working to make money. You're talking about not the phenomenon of not engaging in a community that's being colonized.
Yeah,
and not
maybe that's my stereotype. Yeah. Who the hell even exists that way?
Yeah,
probably no one.
Right. No. You know? Somewhere.
It is an amorphous category.
It is Sunday morning. I think if we went out and walked in and saw those brunch lines, we'd see some people that look like that. But again, if you went up and talked to them, I think. Obviously, people are so diverse that there's no way that you could project what this person feels. That's what I
dehumanized a fantasy.
Yeah.
God, that's part of the problem. You know, that's so interesting. Yeah. We're dealing with ghosts.
Yeah.
We're dealing with fantasies here.
Yeah. I mean, we have to really, I think the core of everything is we need to drop this kind of categorization and this kind of insane need to like figure out who is this person and are they part of a group that I know and have stereotyped in my head and that I know everything I can project all these attitudes towards. We need to stop that. And obviously that's a larger human problem that's been with us for a few years, for a few centuries.
And let's focus on the tangibles, like affordable housing.
Yes. And that's why I think, you know, it's nice to...
and the prison system.
Think about the more kind of physical, the structures that create our world is a much more rich and effective conversation to have than this identity thing, because this identity thing is what separates a working class and what creates a kind of lack of solidarity.
Wow. So this is like an identity politics problem.
I absolutely would think that the hipster thing is part of identity politics, is part of what emerged from the 1960s. We're still kind of like connecting our politics to a kind of fashionable pose, or that you can glean politics from
all that authenticity stuff
from what people wear, etc. And it needs to go away. So I hope that this conversation was a step towards decolonizing our imaginations from those kind of really stupid ways of thinking about people in terms of their identity categories.
So we should focus
while at the same time perhaps recognizing that those identity categories function dramatically are important. I don't want to say like don't talk about your problems from the perspective of a black person because it doesn't matter. We all have problems. I'm not one of those people. But at the same time, the identity thing needs to be dealt with in a way that kind of, like you're saying, it becomes an exchange.
Yeah, you know? I think what the thing to focus on for me, because I need something concrete, is, okay, where do I turn my attention, my energy, my focus? Let's decolonize the neighborhoods.
Yeah.
Let's produce the change we want to see. And, you know, I think we've raised that, especially the first half of this conversation, a lot of issues that are happening in New York City. There's a lot of issues that need attending to. And we need people's participation, and we need their voices, and we need their attention, and we need people in the same rooms together.
So yeah, and it doesn't matter whether those people are wearing skinny jeans.
It
or
really
whatever.
Doesn't.
You can wear the skinny jeans, but be a citizen.
We need coalitions.
Right.
Yep.
Wear the skinny jeans, but
why do we care what people are wearing?
Right.
What matters is the coalition.
Yeah. It's because the skinny jeans are just signifiers, and it's
skinny
really
jeans, baggy pants. We need you.
That being said, I'm not wearing those skinny jeans. They look uncomfortable. So
especially during the July heat.
Yeah. That's suffering for fashion that I'm not willing to do. So this was great. I think that we need to eventually get to identity politics on Topical Fever and the 1960s. And I know we're kind of heading towards moving into talking about the Cold War and the Vietnam War and the war on drugs and all the other wars of the last 50 years.
Yep.
So
war on drugs.
So we'll see you again soon, Justin. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
All right, let's go have brunch. We'll